Street in Portland. Doors at 6:30, showcase at 7:30. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 11:30. Up next is Madness Radio and KBOO Portland.
Washing machine.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices, Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is streaming, podcasting, and archived at madnessradio.net. Welcome to our new broadcast station, KBOO, in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Daniel Mackler. Daniel is a former psychotherapist who has specialized in treating people with psychosis without medication. He's also a filmmaker and the director of the recent film Take These Broken Wings, Recovery from Schizophrenia Without Medication. He recently returned from Europe, where he was researching alternative residences and treatment programs, and he's also the co-editor with Matthew Morrissey of A Way Out of Madness, Dealing with Your Family After You've Been Diagnosed with a Psychiatric Disorder. So welcome to Madness Radio, Daniel Mackler.
Nice to be here, Will Hall. Exciting.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You have just come back from traveling around Europe. You're working on a new film about alternative treatments. Is that right?
Yeah, I actually have the rough cut done of two new films, and each set in a different country, each focusing on a different program that treats people who have been diagnosed with psychosis.
Great. So we want to hear about that and get into the details about those programs a little bit later on the program. But why don't I start by just telling us about how you got interested in taking a non-medication, an alternative approach to experiences of madness, extreme crisis that get diagnosed as psychosis, because you've worked for many years as a therapist working with people.
That's right. I found when I became a therapist, I thought, well, if someone can heal whatever problems they have or work through whatever problems they have without medication, certainly that seems better from so many different angles. But at the same time, I saw some people that wanted to take medication, and certainly in social work school, all my professors said that, you know, when you're dealing with someone who has any diagnosis of psychosis, like schizophrenia or bipolar or schizoaffective or a brief psychotic disorder, that medication is the first line approach. It's necessary. And when you do an intake on someone and they have any sort of psychotic symptoms, the first thing that you need to do ethically is refer them to a psychiatrist for a medication evaluation. And I was a little bit starry-eyed, and I was like, well, maybe that's what I should do, until I became a therapist and I actually started listening to clients and finding that a lot of clients didn't want that. And a lot of people who are on medication, especially the neuroleptics, the antipsychotics, they described them as being horrible and told me just constantly about all sorts of side effects, and basically that they felt worse on the medication, but for very many different reasons, they couldn't come off. Sometimes they were addicted, or sometimes there were all sorts of complicating situations where they might lose their housing, they might lose certain benefits, they might get kicked out of a clinic, and some people were on certain orders where they would even have to be locked up in a psychiatric hospital.
So did you come out of social work school planning to focus on people who have different diagnoses of psychosis, or did that just sort of emerge?
As an intern, a social work intern, a lot of times I got stuck working with the clients that all the paid clinicians didn't want to work with. And a lot of times that was the people who were the most disenfranchised, on the most medication, and with the most severe and complex problems. And what I found is that something in me got ignited, some part of me that just had always, all my life, felt like an underdog and had been put down in very many ways and disrespected. And I found that the people with the most severe diagnoses were the people that actually my heart went out to the most, and the people that at some deep level inside of me I related to the most. And I felt like these are the people who nobody cared about. I had several people who had severe diagnoses who were basically just passed from intern to intern at mental health clinics. And whenever the next batch of interns would come in and the previous batch would leave, they'd get assigned a new therapist because none of the permanent clinicians wanted to work with them. So people who were hearing voices and people whose behavior was considered strange or bizarre, people who had body odor, people who didn't practice certain types of personal cleanliness or look like quote-unquote high-functioning people. And so I found people who were put in a position, if they wanted therapy, that they constantly had to find somebody new every 8 months or something like that. And basically, a big part of their problem in life, from what I heard them say, was that they had no connections with anyone. And then in the therapeutic field itself, they were put in a position where they weren't even allowed to connect with their therapist for more than 8 months. Another example I could have was I spent 10 weeks doing a summer internship at the wonderful and fantastic New York State Psychiatric Institute on their electroshock therapy ward, their ECT ward, which also had women with eating disorders on the ward. And I used to go down and spend a lot of time on the schizophrenia research unit, which is considered one of the best schizophrenia units in the country, only to get down there and discover that the place made me want to vomit. They used to take clients out and they used to put them in case conferences with tons of psychiatrists and psychologists and interns, and everyone would just sit there and watch them, and everyone could ask them questions from the audience. And this is a place that was supposed to be ethical, and I found instead that they'd get these vulnerable, terrified people sitting up in front of a room of 40 or 50 people, and they'd get complete strangers from the audience picking them apart with questions. And they'd have some moderator, who was usually a psychiatrist, sort of deciding who would be called on. The person who was considered the patient wasn't even allowed to do the calling on himself or herself. And it was really sort of like a freak show. And it was horrible. It was almost like – it was almost sort of like raping a human being's psyche. And I just remember thinking, this is disgusting. This makes me really angry. And then the other thing that happened is when I started working, I started speaking out about what I was seeing, and I started getting a fairly unpopular reputation where I was working. And the problem is, because of that, I wasn't making great friends with the other clinicians I worked with. I mean, I liked them, and there was always a politeness, but I think they'd all go and hang out with each other, and I was sort of isolated because I was so different. And what I found a lot, especially toward the end of my first few years of working in clinics, was that clinicians didn't want to refer me their quote-unquote higher-functioning patients. They would refer those kind of patients to their friends, and they would refer me the scraps. That's how the therapy clinics considered the people that had a lot of problems. They considered them like the less desirable patients. So I ended up working with a lot of people that nobody else wanted to work with, people who had the tough diagnoses, especially the people who had the tough diagnoses who had rebellious attitudes, aka didn't want to take their medications as prescribed. And over time, what I started discovering is the people who were rebellious, I didn't care what their diagnosis was. They could be quote-unquote high function, or they could be quote-unquote totally disenfranchised from society and not fitting in at all, not able to work, on disability. I loved working with the rebellious people because what I found is there was just some connection I was able to make when people had a rebellious spirit. And I started working with people and realizing that everything basically I'd been taught in school was a huge lie, especially when it came to people who had the most severe diagnoses.
So say more about that. How was it that you were taught these lies in school? What were some of the things that you discovered?
Well, one very simple thing was in school, they taught us the first most important thing is to listen to the client. That's the first number one rule of being a social worker or a therapist. Listen to the client, meet the client where he or she is at. But then at the same time, we got a completely conflicting message that if someone had a diagnosis of psychosis, we actually weren't supposed to listen to them. What we were supposed to do then is we were supposed to trust our own judgment above what they said. So really what we were being told is don't listen to them, don't listen to the delusions, don't listen to the hallucinations, refer them for medications, make sure they take their medications, and that was suddenly our job. And when people said, I don't want to take my medications or my medications make me feel awful, we were supposed to give back this teleprompter script that said, well, you need to take your medications. They're good for you. Of course, they're going to have certain side effects, but the effect of the medication is going to outweigh the effects of, you know, the side effects. So you're going to have to take them anyways, and we're supposed to follow up. And suddenly it's like we weren't supposed to be therapists anymore. We were supposed to be more like policemen who were chasing after people and punishing them and getting them in trouble if they didn't do what they were supposed to. And it was all supposed to be done in the name of for their own good. And what I found is that was complete and it was a lie, and it was offensive to people. And what we were also told was that when people reacted, people labeled as clients, reacted to having their therapist suddenly be an agent of the state, being like a police force, and the clients got angry, which was appropriate, angry and frustrated and felt betrayed, we were supposed to use that. Now, they weren't saying this explicitly, but actually sometimes they were, the people who taught us and the supervisors, that we were supposed to use that as a further sign of their pathology, that they don't have self-control, that, you know, that they have more mental problems, that they're unstable, that they're, if they feel betrayed, then they're paranoid. And so if we're dealing with people that already have severe diagnoses, it's very, very easy to fit them into a category of being sick when they have any sort of healthy reaction to being mistreated. And
so you would see clients who were justifiably angry because of the way that they were being treated by the care that they were being given. And then that anger would then itself be seen as a symptom of their pathology, their illness, their disorder.
And that would be also considered a symbol of their untreatability, of the fact that they were incurable. And so the whole way the system was set up, I saw so many clinicians do it, is that it was not there to help people. It was instead there to pressure them to do what this preconceived idea of the system was. And the whole preconceived idea was to get people to take their medications, to go into the hospital, and basically to be docile, subservient, broken people. And that infuriated me because on a personal level, at some very, very deep psychological level, that was exactly how I was treated by my family as a child. And that just absolutely infuriated me. Even though I was never in the psychiatric system, I was never put on medications against my will. Everything that I saw happening to these clients just enraged me because this is how my parents treated me at some deep, profound level. And then suddenly I was like, I was hooked. And I was like, I'm here to fight for people. And the worst thing that can happen is they can take my license away. That's the worst thing that they can do to me. Whereas for my clients, the worst thing that could happen to them was they could be sent to prison, psychiatric hospitals, they could be locked against their will, and they could be force injected, they could be held down. For me, the worst that could happen was I could lose my license. And I made a decision a long time ago. The worst they could do is take my license, and I'm going to fight, and I'm going to be willing to lose it. And I made a decision a long time ago that I'm going to be ethical. I'm going to do what I feel is right, not what the system has told me, because I felt the system was clearly, clearly unethical. And all I ever heard, once I became very outspoken in this attitude, and in sessions with my clients, I was very outspoken about this. And suddenly what happened is I found my clients started opening up and telling me all sorts of stuff that they never told other people because they felt safe. I was like, I'm not going to have you locked up. I'm never going to have you, you know, force medicated against your will. I'm not even going to suggest medication. If you want medication, that's a different story. I still think we can always try to find alternatives to put medication as a last option. But if you want it, that's your right. And I can help you try to find a psychiatrist who might be wise in giving you informed consent. But for people who didn't want to take medication, they had a hell of an ally in me because I was angry about what psychiatry was doing.
Daniel, what would you say to someone maybe who's listening to the program and saying, well, wait a second, don't, these are people who have mental illness. They need their medications. They need to be treated with these pharmaceutical interventions because I mean, they have a biological mental illness. And, you know, one of the things about mental illness is that it makes you confused about what's real and not what's not real. So of course it makes sense that doctors and the therapists are trying to pressure them to take their medications because that's going to make them feel better, right?
Okay. So what I would say to somebody like that is that actually there are very many cases where what you just said is absolutely completely accurate. And the people for whom that's completely accurate are the people who have been on heavy neuroleptics for a long, long time. And because of the neuroleptics, they can't get off their medications very easily. They do need their medications, and they do have a biological brain problem. And that's called addiction to heavy, heavy neuroleptics and all the side effects of the medication.
Neuroleptics meaning the antipsychotics that get prescribed for schizophrenia and bipolar and psychosis.
So sometimes I would say that to my clients. I'm like, I know you want to get off your medication. I want to help you get off your medication. The thing is, you've got to be wise about it because you can't just come off your medication quickly. You actually have a brain problem, and that's caused by the medication.
But what about the other side of it, of someone who's coming in and they're maybe suicidal, or they've been living on the street, or they're having wild, terrifying visions, or they're hearing voices, or they're totally shut down? And then the traditional approach is to say, well, look, these are symptoms of a mental illness, a mental disorder. Let's treat you with medications.
Yeah, I was being a little provocative with my last answer. The bottom line is, everybody who's not on medication, when people tell them you've got a brain disorder and you've got mental illness, that's complete crap. And it's not true. Now, if somebody desperately wants to take medication, I, again, think that's their right. But at the same time, if somebody comes to me and they're having a lot of problems that might be labeled as psychosis, and they really want to kill themselves, I never would tell someone to take medication, because I think often that takes away someone's very basis of hope that they can figure it out themselves. And I think if you want to empower someone, you try to help them find completely other ways to do it, where the strength comes from within them, not where the strength comes from a bottle of pills that you got to take.
What about situations like someone who can't sleep, though?
Well, that's a very interesting thing, because I was just visiting the Open Dialogue place up in northern Finland, in western Lapland. They see a lot of people who have first episode psychosis where they do prescribe medication there, but they prescribe short-term sleeping pills just for a couple of days. So I don't have a problem with that, but I was never a prescriber. So if I saw someone who, let's say, came to me, who was referred to me, who hadn't slept in a few days, they were having symptoms that might be described as psychosis, they were hearing voices, and they were having ideas that by conventional standards would be considered bizarre or strange or impossible, and they couldn't keep their thoughts in control, I would look at them and say, my God, I'd probably be that way if I didn't sleep for 4 days.
Exactly. That's one of the reasons that I raised that, because it's just such a common thing that sleep deprivation drives people into these psychotic states, or states that get called psychotic.
Right. And it's hard. I mean, what would I do? I'd try to find any way in to figure out how to help the person get to sleep. Now, sometimes people were fairly irrational if they hadn't slept in days, and sometimes they were quite irrational. I would just put it on the bottom, put it right down on the table. This is the number one thing you need to do. You need to figure out how to get to sleep. Especially, this is something that was key. If I saw someone that was really suicidal and I was scared, I would say, come every day. Every day. And they say, well, I don't know if I can afford coming 5 days a week. I'd say, who said 5 days a week? Every day means 7 days a week. And get people to come every day. And sometimes come for 2 hours. And sometimes, not sometimes, I had it happen very often. The people who were very, very suicidal, if they came every day, a lot of times the suicidality would go away fairly quickly. But then it would be like, often when people were suicidal, they just had lost their hope, or always, I suppose, they'd lost their hope. And sometimes it was just for lack of a human connection.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio. We're speaking with Daniel Mackler. He's a former psychotherapist who specialized in treating people who are diagnosed with psychosis without medication. Daniel is a filmmaker who is the director of Take These Broken Wings, Recovery from Schizophrenia Without Medication. And he recently returned from Europe, where he was researching different alternative residences and treatment programs. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Daniel, did you find that you often were behaving yourself as a therapist in very unconventional, innovative ways? Because that's a pretty different way of working, to see someone every day or have them come for a couple of hours. It sounds like you had a lot of flexibility and creativity in the way that you work with people.
I never felt that I was practicing in a terribly alternative or radical or creative way. I just felt like I was being myself. But I noticed when I worked in the clinics and I would share even little bits with other therapists of what I was doing, they would give me this really funny look, like I was out of my mind.
What kinds of things were you doing?
Talking to people about things that were labeled as delusions, getting into their delusion with them sometimes, treating it as if it wasn't crazy, but actually listening to it. Respecting it.
Because the clinicians tend to think, oh, you're just going to make it worse. You're going to join someone's delusion. You're going to reinforce their paranoia. You're going to make them think that it's real, and you actually have to educate them that it's not real.
Or another thing that clinicians would say to me is, that's really insulting to treat somebody that way, because you know what they're saying is delusional. So if you start pretending that it's actually real, you're actually being really disrespectful to this client.
Well, did you feel like you were being dishonest with people? I mean, if someone says that, oh, so-and-so is, my neighbor is broadcasting their thoughts into my mind and they're reading my mind every night, would you just say, yeah, that's happening, that's true?
Sometimes. I had so many different ones. I mean, I don't want to be specific because people could hear their own story. But if somebody, what was the example then you gave? Someone could think that people are broadcasting thoughts into their mind. I would ask questions about it and say, what is the person saying? So in a sense, yes, I would treat it as if it were real. But at the same time, I would also allow myself that tiny little 1% shred in my head that had skepticism that maybe what they're saying was real. That would be my answer to those clinicians. It's like I was dealing with someone when people were labeled with these things called psychosis, that at some level they were sort of in that same place where there was I always believed there was a certain reason that people were thinking the ideas that got labeled as psychosis. And I would give people the benefit of the doubt and not treat them as a child, but I would say instead, when I talk with a 4-year-old, treat them as a human being. Forget how old they are, but just treat someone as a human being and take what they're saying at face value and engage with people.
Because if it's something that's really deeply preoccupying someone and they're focused on it, then there is some level of reality. They're living inside of it.
And people's feelings are real. I mean, I have my own experiences in my life. I've had a lot of crazy experiences that are really terrifying, where I got into thoughts, you know, and fears and ideas that could be labeled as paranoid or delusional. I don't think I ever hallucinated. I would say actually I've had taste hallucinations before, and those are extremely unpleasant, feeling like I'm eating metal or eating dog poo or something like that with the taste and becoming really afraid about it. But a lot of my experiences that would probably have been labeled as psychotic if I'd gone to a hospital and spoken with a clinician were experiences when I was hitchhiking and smoked marijuana. And I became very paranoid sometimes. I became afraid that people were going to rape me and afraid that people were plotting to hurt me or kill me. And I would become very scared. And sometimes I would just freak out and ask people to pull over and get out of the car and later think about it when I'd calmed down and realized, you know, it was totally just my fear. But I was putting myself in really extremely stressful positions. And it's like, when I would talk about it afterward with people, especially if I was still somewhat in that very paranoid place, I really needed people who took me seriously and believed what I was saying. Even if later on I was able to come to the conclusion that what I was saying may not have been that realistic, the fears I had were realistic, and I needed someone who would meet me right on the level of where my fears were and where my feelings were. And that made me feel respected. So I think to turn around as a therapist and give that exact same thing is actually very respectful, and to just totally undercut somebody's emotional reality is very disrespectful, because the ideas that people have are just the manifestation of the feelings.
So you, at some point, Daniel, you made a decision to sort of step back from being a psychotherapist and then start to research programs around the world, especially in Europe, that are really bringing some of the insights that you learned from your private practice into creating alternatives for what is it that people really do need.
Spent most of my time in Northern Europe and Finland and in Scandinavia visiting different treatment programs that help people, the same kind of people that I was working with. Sometimes people with that thing called first break psychosis, and sometimes people who had been horribly diagnosed and labeled and crunched through the psychiatric system and squished through the cracks of the psychiatric system for years and decades. And also what I did is I met with tons of psychiatric survivors who had recovered from all around Europe. There's one that I like the best, and this is a program in Gothenburg, Sweden, for people who have been crunched through the system and been crushed often by the system, the psychiatric system. But I also think that programs can be as diverse as human beings are creative. So this was a system that was started by two social workers back in the late 80s, maybe 87, 88. And what they started a program for was taking people who were diagnosed with psychosis, with schizophrenia, and other of the roughest diagnoses, and people who were just given up for lost, basically, by the system. And they placed them in farm families in the countryside. And so basically the farm families became a kind of foster care. But there already were programs like this running in Sweden, foster care agencies for people who were diagnosed with severe diagnoses, but they weren't that successful. And this program did some things differently. One thing that they did was they provided intensive support to the farm families. So the farm family became the primary agency, the primary therapeutic agency for helping the person who was living in their family. And they chose families much like Soteria has did. They chose people, families who were compassionate, who were stable, who were loving, who were honest. So they chose people not at all based on their psychiatric experience. And they actually particularly wanted people that had no experience in the psychiatric system. They just wanted people who were good people, good, honest, humble, hardworking people. Then the agency would provide very, very intensive support to the family, helping them work through whatever it was that they were going through. So basically, giving them an ear to talk about. They call it supervision. And what they basically provided is an open 24-hour-a-day lifeline to these families so they could call if there was ever a problem. And then there was regular weekly meetings. And
then what happened? Did people find that they started to change and get better? What's the effectiveness of this program?
Basically, everybody I talked to had tons and tons and tons of experience and experiences of people who had gotten well, who had gotten off their medication, who had reintegrated into what's conventionally considered society and gotten back to work, gotten on with their lives. And so, and the other thing, the first thing that happens when the people get into their program is this is how they have it worked out, part of the Swedish medical system. They stop diagnosing them the minute the people walk into the program. People don't have a diagnosis. They go to a family. When they go to the family is not given a whole printout. Oh, yes, you're having someone diagnosed with schizophrenia and they have this history. And previously they were diagnosed with, you know, bipolar affective, blah, blah, blah. No, forget all that. There is no diagnosis. Instead, you have a person coming and the person's got a lot of problems. And the people, they don't use diagnosis from beginning to end.
Daniel, what would you say to someone who says, well, look, that's in Sweden. The culture is so different. That could never happen in the United States or Canada.
I did it. I didn't use diagnosis. I just thought of the person as this is so-and-so or this is so-and-so. This is John. This is Mary. I don't think of myself as a diagnosis. It's like, yeah, I have anxiety sometimes, but I don't think of myself as an anxiety disorder. I'm just a person with anxiety.
So do you think that this model of putting people in a family, taking people out of institutional context and putting them in a family and then providing lots and lots of therapeutic support, do you think that that's potentially something that could work in the United States?
I don't see why it couldn't. This is what's so funny is psychiatry is made to be this super complex thing that's so difficult to learn, and you have to learn your school of therapy, and you have to do – it's like this was simple. I mean the primary therapists in this organization are families who have no experience. They're just – I mean it's just the routines of the family, the compassion of the family, the structure of the family, getting out and milking cows. Come on. You can't be in bed all day. You may be a little bonkers today, but come on out. You're going to get out and work with us. Or they had so many stories that I heard, and now they've expanded it. They're not just farm families. They have people who do all sorts of other jobs. I think there's still a predominance of farm families. They inspired me because also what really inspired me is when I sat down and talked with the clients. And what I heard is people who are happy with psychiatry. And that's not something you hear very much in the United States or anywhere.
Daniel, we are just about out of time. Give people your contact information, your website.
My website is www.irarsoul.com. So that's irarsoul.com.
Daniel Mackler, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Thank you, Will. It's great.
You've been listening to an interview with Daniel Mackler. Daniel is a former psychotherapist who specialized with treating people with psychosis without medication. He's a filmmaker and director of the recent film Take These Broken Wings, Recovery from Schizophrenia Without Medication. He's the co-editor of A Way Out of Madness, Dealing with Your Family After You've Been Diagnosed with a Psychiatric Disorder. And he recently returned from Europe, where he is researching and creating two films on alternative treatments for people with psychosis. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, voices and visions from outside mental health. Madness Radio is co-sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Hosted by Will Hall. Music producer is John Rice, with technical assistance from Jeremy Lanceman. Listen to our internet stream, podcasts, and show archives at madnessradio.net. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, including KBOO in Oregon, WXOJ and WBCR in Massachusetts, Alaska's KWMD, and WPRR in Michigan. If you have an idea for a story or guest on Madness Radio, to help get us broadcast on a station near you, or if you just want to share what's in your head, contact radio@madnessradio.net.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is the Noontime Jamboree.
some cherry drops, then I'll pop him one he won't see. He's big and pink and not like me. He sees no light, he sees no reason for the fight. With my silver bullet and my silver bullet, I have not seen his face till I'm only feet away. Unbeknown to my parade, I look in American eyes. I see little life, I see little wife. He's struck alive with some in me. With my silver bullet, my silver bullet.
Pulling on the pin,
ooh, pull out, pull out the pin.
Pulling on the pin, oh, 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 oh.
Just one thing.
And you are tuned to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM. It's time now for the Noontime Jamboree. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from True West, presenting an evening with the Americana, Tex-Mex, and Western Swing of the Mavericks, Saturday, September 10th at the Roseland Theater. Tickets and information for this 21 and over performance by the Mavericks on September 10th are available at cascadetickets.com. And also by Curiosities, a vintage mall serving the West Side with space for over 70 dealers and a selection of vintage, retro, mid-century clothing, jewelry, and antiques. Curiosities is located at 12705 Southwest Beaverdam Road in Beaverton. More